tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Lippin reporting. U.S. officials say a small group of American ground troops is heading to Syria to advise and assist in the fight against Islamic State militants. A senior Obama administration official said Friday the president authorized fewer than 50 special operations forces to deploy to northern Syria. The official says those U.S. troops will coordinate with pro-Western rebels and U.S.-led coalition forces combating the IS group. It is the first time Washington is publicly sending U.S. ground forces to Syria for an open-ended mission rather than for a specific raid. Diplomats from 17 countries plus the United Nations and European Union have begun talks in Vienna on Syria's political future. The meeting is the first of its kind because it includes Iran, a longtime ally of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is in the Austrian capital, staying with other reporters at a hotel near the talks venue. She says some of the top diplomats attending the meeting spoke with reporters on Friday morning.
The French foreign minister did stop and speak to us. He said that the first step was to find ways to conduct the fight against terrorist groups in Syria in a more efficient way. He said after that, a political transition had to be organized. Shortly after he left, the German foreign minister, Steinmeier, came through our lobby. He said it would not be possible to resolve all of the issues today, but that today's meeting was an important first step.
In Syria's latest violence, a rights group says a government missile strike on a rebel-held neighborhood near Damascus killed at least 40 people. This is VOA. The declared winner of Tanzania's closely contested presidential election, John Magufuli, was due to receive a victory certificate on Friday. His supporters danced in the streets of the capital, Dar es Salaam, late Thursday in celebration. Magufuli heads Tanzania's ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi Party, or CCM. The main opposition candidate, Edward Lowassa, came in second and has called for a recount. But international observers have described the election as peaceful and credible. Manila has welcomed an international court's decision to consider Philippine complaints about China's land reclamation activities in disputed waters of the South China Sea. The Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague said Thursday it will consider 7 of the Philippines' 15 complaints about Chinese claims of exclusive rights to South China Sea waters and economic zones. China has rejected the court's involvement in the South China Sea dispute, saying questions of sovereignty and maritime borders lie outside the court's jurisdiction. Philippine Foreign Affairs spokesman Charles Jose said Manila is trying to persuade the court that it does have authority to judge Beijing's claims to the Chinese-built artificial islands.
We are cautiously confident because they said there are 7 other issues that they will consider the jurisdictional issue in tandem with the merits. So I think they will also find jurisdiction in those claims.
In the past 2 years, China has dredged up large amounts of sand from the seafloor to enlarge 7 South China Sea reefs that appear naturally above the surface only at low tide, turning them into islands. A suspected al-Qaeda member and former British resident held for 13 years at the U.S. prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has arrived in London after being released by U.S. authorities. Shaker Amar was flown to London on Friday on a plane chartered by the British government. British Prime Minister David Cameron welcomed Amar's release. Cameron also said he wanted to reassure the British public that his government has taken steps to ensure their safety. A British official said there were no plans to detain the 46-year-old Saudi national whose family lives in London. His wife and children are British. And a Palestinian man has attacked Israeli civilians in Jerusalem. Israeli authorities say the assailant wounded one man before being shot by security forces on Friday. They say another Israeli was hurt by the gunfire as the Israeli security personnel subdued the assailant. I'll be back in 1 hour for more international headlines. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The president-elect, Mr. John Pombe Magufuli, was awarded the certificate that recognizes him officially as the winner of the 2015 Tanzania presidential election.
That's VOA's Vincent Makori in Dar es Salaam. Details coming up.
Also, Central African Republic's interim president says the nation is prepared to elect a president and to rebuild a country torn by years of violence. And the UN says West Africa's regional forces are ready to take the fight to Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the International Organization for Migration reports migrant deaths on the Mediterranean sea routes to Europe are breaking all previous records. IOM confirms 3,350 fatalities so far this year, surpassing the record-breaking death toll of 3,279 for all of 2014. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration reports deaths off the Greek islands, notably Lesbos and Samos, have surged with the cold weather setting in. It estimates 435 men, women, and children have died on the eastern Mediterranean route linking Turkey to Greece in the last 3.5 weeks. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says there appears to be no end in sight for this rising toll of migrants and refugees desperate to reach European shores.
We know of at least 22 off Greece, in addition to almost that many not confirmed in the last 24 hours in Greece. Also, possibly as many as 40 killed in Spain this morning. There's no sign of this carnage tapering off, and we're deeply concerned about what's ahead as the weather gets colder.
The past few days have been replete with shipwrecks and deaths. IOM describes Wednesday, October 28th, as the deadliest day in the Mediterranean waters this year, with five fatal shipwrecks. Two occurred off the Greek island of Lesbos, another two off the coast of Samos, and one off the coast of Agathonist. The agency says the worst incident was off the coast of Lesbos when a wooden boat carrying from 300 to 500 migrants sank. The UN Refugee Agency warns the seaborne death toll will continue to rise as long as thousands of refugees are forced to make these perilous journeys to escape war and persecution. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says there needs to be a safe alternative to people risking their lives in these dangerous sea crossings.
There also has to be a much more determined and concrete search for legal avenues for people to make this journey to Europe. At the moment, we're seeing hundreds and hundreds of people making this journey by sea, overland. Lives are being lost.
Edwards says those lucky enough to make it ashore alive are confronted with what he calls appallingly long lines of people waiting to be registered so they can move on to other countries in Europe. He says reception facilities capable of quickly and efficiently screening and processing new arrivals must be established. But it's an open question who would take on that considerable task. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras lashed out at the rest of the European Union for failing to take responsibility for the migrant crisis. He spoke as Greece witnesses some of the greatest tragedies since the mass migrations began 2 years ago. In the last 3 days, 50 migrants and refugees have died on the Aegean Sea trying to reach Greece. Greece has become the major route for more than 600,000 Middle Eastern and African migrants. Coast Guard and merchant vessels have rescued about 600 people in the past 24 hours. Thousands of others have reached shore safely. The Prime Minister accuses Western countries of shedding crocodile tears over the drownings. That's a term used for fake crying. He questions what Western powers are doing to help thousands of children cramming the roads of Greece and the Balkans trying to reach Europe. In other news, Turkey's Doğan News Agency says four Syrian children drowned off the coast of Turkey today when their flimsy dinghy capsized in bad weather. The Turkish Coast Guard recovered the bodies of the children aged 1 to 4. Another 19 migrants, all wearing life jackets, were rescued. The International Office of Migration says the death toll by drowning in Mediterranean and Aegean waters now totals 3,327.
International and local election observers have praised Tanzania for conducting peaceful and well-administered polls. They are calling on all Tanzanians to bury their political differences now that the election is over. Our colleague Vincent Macoria is in Dar es Salaam following developments. He says today was a big day for the ruling CCM party and the new president, John Magufuli.
The president-elect, Mr. John Pombe Magufuli, was awarded the certificate that recognizes him officially as the winner of the 2015 Tanzania presidential election. And so what this means is that the Electoral Commission has completed its job by awarding that certificate. That was the end of its mission. The next step is now for the Supreme Court to swear in Mr. Magufuli as the new president of Tanzania on the 5th of November.
What is the mood like now since the elections are over?
For the winning party, its supporters, its jubilation, it is celebration. Just immediately after the awarding of the certificate, members of that party headed off to the headquarters of Chama cha Mapinduzi, where thousands of citizens were waiting to listen to the new president and also the former president and other leaders as they celebrated. But on the other side, of course, it's very sad for the opposition that has already said it does not recognize this result. It's a fairly miserable day for them, not only because they lost, because they really cannot seek any legal recourse. In fact, after today, nobody is expected even to demonstrate against the election results, because by law, the country has a new president-elect.
On that note, I understand that international and local election observers, they are calling for all of Tanzanians to bury their political differences now that the election is over. So do you really think that's going to happen?
That's going to happen on the mainland, but we have an unresolved issue on the Zanzibar archipelago, where the Electoral Commission right there in Zanzibar nullified the election results on Wednesday, something that shocked many. It has been considered totally illegal by many sites, including the international monitoring teams that actually said the election there went on fine, and they don't understand how the Electoral Commission in Zanzibar could, 2 days after announcing all the results and awarding people certificates of victory, especially at the level of Member of Parliament and the House of Representatives, they could again go back and say this election is nullified. So that remains unresolved up to this point. So Zanzibar does not have the president, and there is no word up to this point as to what's going to be the fate of those who had been elected before this was annulled. So we're waiting to see what is going to be the resolution to this issue.
Looking ahead for the new president, Magufuli, what do you think his next big challenge is going to be as president?
The next big challenge is, of course, to deliver on the promises they made, because the party, Chama cha Mapinduzi, has been around for a long time. Many people, especially the youth, feel that it hasn't really taken the country to the levels of economic development. And there's high levels of unemployment in this country. There's lack of infrastructure in many parts of this country. Now, the slogan of the Chama cha Mapinduzi this time, under which Mr. Magufuli was running, is that here it is just work. He has sold himself as a person who is going to work hard to deliver on the areas where the government has not delivered in the past many years, including pushing developments ahead, creating employment, and, of course, building infrastructure and getting this country out of the group of some of the most poorest countries on the continent. So it's a big challenge, and time will tell how far it can go in achieving those objectives.
Vincent, in looking at this election, is there anything that stands out to you in terms of Tanzania setting a precedent or being a role model, or any highlights that you think stand out for you in this election?
Really, you cannot say that it has set a role model in terms of the conduct or the process of election. I think the most stark thing that you can say that, you know, comes out of Tanzania is the peaceful nature of the people. They have a completely different demeanors compared to, say, the neighboring countries, that despite of maybe perceptions of interference with the electoral process, generally the people remain peaceful. There might be demonstrations here and there, but overall, they really maintain peace. They treasure their peace. They value their peace. One thing that maybe stands out in this election that other people may learn and hope not to repeat those kind of mistakes, including the opposition here, is that there is no legal recourse for the aggrieved side. And I think that came out very clearly when the opposition said that it doesn't recognize this election. The question was, then what? Of course, absolutely nothing. There's nothing they can do because under the law, which they should probably have fought to change, the Electoral Commission chairman is the final word. You cannot petition elections in this country.
That was our colleague Vincent McCoury speaking to us from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Central African Republic's interim president says the election of a new president must take place in December despite the recent sectarian violence in the capital. President Katrine Sambapanza says the nation is prepared to elect a president and rebuild the country torn by years of violence. The national election is scheduled for December 13th. Meanwhile, three residents of Bangui were killed yesterday in mob violence as they left the city's Muslim enclave. Witnesses say a Christian was killed later in the day as he entered the same enclave. The death toll in Bangui's protests this week is 11. Hundreds of protesters blocked a main road in Bangui yesterday to denounce the violence. Residents fled Christian neighborhoods to avoid further reprisal attacks. Mostly Muslim Seleka rebels seized power in the majority Christian nation in 2013, prompting lethal reprisals by Christian militias known as anti-Balaka.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN says West Africa's regional forces are ready to take the fight to Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency. Special UN representative to West Africa, Mohamed Ibn Chambas, says the long-awaited launch of a coordinated campaign against the militants is ready. The generals plan to attack Boko Haram camps in the Sambisa Forest as soon as the rainy season ends. Forces from Nigeria and Chad have forced many of the insurgent forces into hiding in recent months. However, suicide bombers continue to kill scores of civilians in Nigeria's northeast and across borders in Niger and Cameroon. The joint force is endorsed by the African Union and includes troops from Benin, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and Nigeria. They will be aided by aerial surveillance by drones from a U.S. base in northern Cameroon.
Nigeria and its allies gear up for a major dry season offensive against the jihadists of Boko Haram. Experts offer different views of who the enemy is and whether this West African army can bring an end to 6 years of bloodshed in Nigeria's northeast. From Washington, VOA's David Arnold spoke to political and military analysts and has this report.
The insurgency in northeast Nigeria was born in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State. This is one of the three Nigerian states the violent Salafist Muslims of Boko Haram have tried for 6 years to turn into an independent Islamic state. Its roots and possibly much of its support comes from within the country. Former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria John Campbell wonders just how much local support Boko Haram is really getting from surrounding communities.
It has always been difficult to judge just how much popular support they have. On the other hand, A movement that has been able to survive since 2011 appears to continue to be able to gain recruits and could carry out an operation involving the kidnapping of hundreds of girls, not just a Chibok. All implies that there is some kind of popular base.
Boko Haram has its roots in a religious sect that attracted poor Nigerians. The poverty remains a constant in Nigeria's northern states. Martin Roberts of Jane's Defense Weekly sees the economic problems as a reason why the brutal insurgency survives.
This hardline interpretation is convincing people to follow Boko Haram from a religious point of view, but also as it enjoys some successes and gathers resources, it's able to offer a lot of people in the Northeast simply a monthly wage. This is a very impoverished part of still a reasonably poor country in which the state has always been absent. There are a few formal forms of employment. Somebody comes along, they offer to pay you a few $100 a month just to run around carrying a gun. It's still an attractive proposition. A lot of their money comes from local political leaders paying them off. Protection money of various descriptions. They also used to indulge in bank raids. And now, thanks to the closer links with Islamic State, at least through the faction of Boko Haram led by Abubakar Shekau, that's another source of revenue on which they can count.
Whether Boko Haram has sustainable sources of support from the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, or any other terrorist group at work in Africa and the Middle East remains an argument. Campbell says most of Boko Haram's strength is local.
In my view, Boko Haram has relatively little in common with other international terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, to say nothing of the so-called Islamic State. I see Boko Haram as a populist grassroots revolt against the Nigerian political economy, part of which has some kind of coherence and coherent organization that we associate with Abubakar Shekau. But other aspects of it appear to be intensely localized and not very well coordinated. Under those circumstances, if you're going to try to move against Boko Haram, you have to do something about the local drivers of it. And clearly one of the most important local drivers of it is security service abuses of the local population. If I were giving President Buhari advice, mine would be to introduce immediate reform, particularly the police.
The Nigerian government's historic disregard for the welfare of the northern states and the heavy-handed manner of its security forces have fostered distrust among many northern Nigerians. Whether Boko Haram can sustain itself with the loyalties of some Nigerians or not, Robert says the jihadist movements to the north and the Islamic State in Iraq could sustain Boko Haram fighters as the multinational force seeks to destroy them.
One thing worth watching is how the links with Islamic State develop. At the moment, there's only one faction of Boko Haram, but there are now three factions. One of them is the one that was formerly led by Shekau that has declared allegiance to Islamic State. Shekau is no longer even the leader of this group because Islamic State has sent down a Libyan veteran of various al-Qaeda wars to direct operations. There's talk that the second most powerful faction could be persuaded to join Islamic State. That would be a very worrying indicator. At the moment, the training, the men and material that's coming down from Islamic State Central in Libya is fairly limited because of the geographical distance involved and because of the fact that Islamic State is under some sort of pressure to reassert its dominance in Libya itself. But if that changes, they're clearly going to be able to provide more support to their West Africa province.
Nigeria's traditional Muslim leadership in the north hopes the regional forces will be successful in ending Boko Haram's reign of terror. Among them are the Sultan of Sokoto and the Emir of Kano, who was once the head of the Nigerian Central Bank. To say nothing of President Muhammadu Buhari, another Muslim from the north who made a political promise last summer to defeat Boko Haram. This is VOA's David Arnold in Washington.
Talks resume this week at the World Trade Organization in Geneva on the question of renewing the pharmaceutical patent trade exemption for the world's least developed countries. Representing those countries at the talks are Uganda, Nepal, and Bangladesh. At issue is a U.S. government proposal to impose a 10-year limit on the exemption. Ugandan officials say that change could cost lives in the countries that need access to new low-cost generics the most. Elizabeth Pala reports from Kampala.
Under current World Trade Organization guidelines, 34 of the world's least developed countries, classified as LDCs, are exempt from pharmaceutical trade patents. Most of these countries are in Africa. The exemption means LDCs like Uganda can import or manufacture low-cost generic versions of name-brand drugs, whereas countries considered to be more developed, like for example France or Kenya, cannot. In real terms, that means an LDC like Bangladesh has the right to make or import, either for use or for sale to another LDC, a low-cost generic version of a new medicine that could cost hundreds of dollars a pill in the United States. However, this exemption is set to expire at the end of the year. Uganda is pushing for an indefinite renewal for countries in the LDC bracket. UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, the European Union, and Doctors Without Borders all back this proposal. But the United States wants to restrict the renewal to 10 years. Ugandan health officials say a decade is not enough for Uganda to develop research labs and independent manufacturing. Moses Malumba is the executive director for the Center of Health, Human Rights, and Development in Kampala.
In the era of diseases like HIV/AIDS or tuberculosis and malaria, we really need to access the medicines. Unfortunately, the current discussion seems to be focused on more of rewarding the inventors. And for partners like the United States, it becomes even more sickening if they speak on one hand to provide help, and then on the other hand to adopt policies and laws that will be taking away the medicines.
If the exemption is not renewed this year, that would mean that as of January 1st, LDCs could not manufacture low-cost generics of off-patent drugs, which are typically more than 20 years old. If the U.S. proposal passes, that would be true starting in 2026. With continued high rates of HIV in LDCs like Uganda, alongside growing global concern over antibiotic resistance, officials say limiting access to newer drugs could be catastrophic. Nevin Bradford is the chief executive officer of Cipla Quality Chemicals, one of only two WHO-approved pharmaceutical manufacturing plants in East Africa.
What will happen to the availability of newer drugs? Because, you know, HIV is a virus which mutates, develops resistance. Mm-hmm. Drugs that were very active, first-line treatment 5 years ago, are not so effective, and in some cases have been stopped because the virus has developed resistance. And that also applies to hepatitis and other conditions as well, of course. So you could be in a situation in 5 years' time where the drugs that we're manufacturing and selling now are less effective. And it's the newer drugs that will become first line.
The U.S. Embassy in Kampala says while the United States recognizes the gravity of the situation, intellectual property protections for pharmaceuticals create incentives for investment in research and development of new treatments. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. International and local election observers have praised Tanzania for conducting peaceful and well-administered polls. Central African Republic's interim president says the nation is prepared to elect a president and rebuild a country torn by years of violence. And the UN says West Africa's regional forces are ready to take the fight to Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa, and in our feature segment, malnutrition rates among young children in Mauritania are rising at an alarming rate. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sonny Young. And happy Friday, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Kim. This evening, we celebrate the anniversary of the Rumble in the Jungle, the classic clash in Kinshasa between Muhammad Ali and then world heavyweight boxing champion George Foreman. The fight on October 30th, 1974, has been described as one of the greatest sporting events of the 20th century. Foreman entered the ring undefeated with 40 consecutive victories, and at 25, he was younger and stronger than the 32-year-old Ali. But Ali told his Hall of Fame trainer, the late, great Angelo Dundee, that he had a secret plan for Foreman. He would lean on the ropes and cover up, letting Big George punch him in the arms and body and sap Foreman's energy with what came to be known as Ali's rope-a-dope strategy. And Ali's plan worked. Foreman got tired, and Ali knocked him out with 2 seconds remaining in the eighth round. Angelo Dundee was in Muhammad Ali's corner. Over the years, old Angelo delighted our Voice of America listeners with funny verbal jabs before he died in 2012 at the age of 90. Let's listen in again to Angelo as I ask him about the Rumble in the Jungle.
Hello.
Hey, Angelo.
Yeah.
This is Sonny Young from Voice of America.
Yeah.
How you doing?
All right.
Angelo, reflect a little bit. What are your main memories of that fight in the former Zaire?
Well, you know, it was such an event. You know, you get there and we're the good guys. You know, right there, Ali Boumaye. And he was like a hero there. And the Zaire people are so goddamn nice. It's a shame. You know, the country's having their problems. And everybody I met there was so congenial and nice. And the fun part of it was a guy named Chimpupu Chimpupu Wa Chimpupa. He was the PR guy.
Okay.
And he'd make us go. See, we were outside of Kinshasa. We were like 45 minutes away in the government complex called Nasseli. That's where they entertained all the African nations. And we all had villas facing the Congo River. And God forbid we said Congo River. It was supposed to get called the Zaire River. And we used to look forward to going to the gym every day. In fact, on my off duties, I used to train lizards. It made a good hit with the newspaper guys. When they came, it was a rainy day. We didn't go to the gym. And these lizards, these big lizards, we walking across like the banisters.
Right.
And I said, wait a minute. Let me tell you what I did. And I said, see that lizard? I trained that sucker. Now watch. He's going to go 5 steps and do push-ups. you know, no matter where you go, you got to have a sense of humor.
Angelo, did Foreman train close to Muhammad, or were
He trained right across the way from us, and we used to spy on him. I used to borrow Howard Bingham's telescopic lens and watch him from behind the hiding spots. We're like little kids, you know, because you don't see nothing in the gym. There's nothing to check, you know. But we had fun. So this is the whole key, you know. People don't realize to excel at what you do, you got to have fun with it. And we always had fun with Muhammad every day. Every day, 19 years, I had fun, you know, so what the hell? This is what it's all about.
Angelo, was the weather a factor in that fight, the heat in the former Zaire?
Well, you got to remember, we trained in Florida, Miami. Muhammad loves the heat. In fact, to this day, Muhammad calls me, he threatens me, he's going to come down and sweat. I says, please do.
Do you think the heat bothered Big George more than it did Muhammad?
Well, no. I just think it was meant to be, you know, it's what happens in boxing. Isn't that a horrible career to have, you know, if somebody out there can lick you? Isn't that tough? I mean, you're a great fighter, and there's somebody out there might do a number on you. The only guy that didn't taste that was Rocky Marciano, God bless him, because he retired undefeated. And another kid from Thailand retired undefeated.
Angelo, looking back on the Rumble in the Jungle, would that fight have happened without the electric-haired man, Don King?
No, he was in the right place at the right time. Had the connections, the complexions to give us the right direction. That's what Muhammad used to say about me. Angelo got the connections and the directions to give you the right direction. That's right. So we applied it the other way. No, it was meant to be. Don King's a hell of a promoter. He went there and they wanted to name their country a new name, you know, get rid of that Belgian Congo thing, and then name their country Zaire. And Mobutu's a very, very, you know, that Zaire's a big country. And I think it's bigger than the United States. Yeah, big. And this guy ran it. He was a remarkable guy. He used to go all his provinces by helicopter. He was a hell of a man.
Angelo, where does the Rumble in the Jungle rate in the Muhammad Ali legacy?
Well, it's got to be one of the greatest happenings, the changing of a name, government. Well, Muhammad, you know, was a happening any place we ever went. You know, I get letters 10 a week maybe, you know, letting us want pictures and stuff like that. It's remarkable, you know, because here I was with a guy who was a living legend. And in his career now, I'm his fistic voice. Because the guy can't talk, and I know it breaks his heart. He loved to talk. He loved it because he loved talking to the media. He enjoyed that, and I pride myself with that. I pushed him towards that because if you want to be a superstar, these guys will make you a superstar. And, you know, that's why he was so great with the media. He was the first superstar that did that. Never happened before.
That's the late Hall of Fame boxing trainer Angelo Dundee. With more on the Rumble in the Jungle, here is VOA's Ted Landfair.
In 1974, fans in Zaire had followed his every move surrounding what came to be called the Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman.
Even today, I meet people and they bring up the Ali fight. And they still think the fight is going on. They need to be on my side or Ali. They don't know the fight. It doesn't exist anymore. But you learn great lessons from those defeats. You learn that it's just a day in your life. It shouldn't be taken over. It shouldn't consume you. And it's just a moment. And enjoy every moment.
Boumaye, the crowd shouted. Kill him, Ali. Brutal words for perhaps the world's most famous pacifist. Muhammad Ali won 56 of 61 professional fights. In his last two bouts in 1980 and 1981, he was already showing the debilitating effects of Parkinson's disease, the brain disorder that affects muscle control.
Thanks, Ted. That's VOA's Ted Landfair. The year after the epic Ali Foreman fight in 1975, American soul singer Don Covey released his tribute song titled, you guessed it, Rumble in the Jungle. Let's give it a listen.
Rumble in the jungle, Ali, Ali, rumble in the jungle, Ali, Ali, rumble in.
a motherland, yeah. Ali and Foreman, yeah. I show down to see who would wear, oh yeah, the heavyweight crown.
Muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. The fistic world was dull and weary. With a champ like Liston, things had to be dreary. Then someone with color, someone with dash, brought fight fans a running with cash.
Show me the money.
This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance. I am the greatest.
VOA.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, malnutrition rates among young children in Mauritania rising at an alarming rate. And next, a photo festival in Mali's capital, Bamako. But first, some music. It is Zahara of South Africa with Umutuwalo.
Yeah.
South Africa's Zahara with Umutuwalo.
Nice song, Yeheyas. Well, the World Food Program says hundreds of thousands of people in Mauritania are going hungry, and malnutrition rates among young children are rising at an alarming rate. As Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, the WFP says it urgently needs $11 million to assist Mauritania.
The World Food Program says Mauritania is bearing the brunt of reoccurring food crises, chronic malnutrition, and instability spilling over from neighboring Mali. About 50,000 refugees from northern Mali are included among the 540,000 particularly vulnerable people the agency needs to assist. Unfortunately, WFP coffers are almost empty. Spokeswoman Bettina Lusher tells VOA the agency only has enough money to provide school lunches to impoverished children for 2 months.
That's one of the big points that we always have. It's a crucially important social safety net to have school meal programs, because that's often, in some cases, the only meal these children get.
Lucia says the increase in the number of children suffering from malnutrition is very worrisome. Latest figures show 14% of children under 5 have acute malnutrition, 4% higher than last year. And in some regions of the country, the data finds rates as high as 28%. That is almost double the World Health Organization's critical emergency threshold. Lucia says children who are acutely malnourished are likely to have lifelong debilitating consequences.
If children under 1,000 days in their life do not get good nutrition, their brains will never develop as other healthy children would. They will never be as productive as other healthy children would.
The World Food Program reports nearly 1 million people in Mauritania, about 1 in 4, do not have enough food to eat to lead healthy lives. Of these, it says, more than 200,000 are severely food insecure and need immediately life-saving assistance. WFP says female-headed families are the worst off. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Mali's photo festival, Bamako Encounters, is returning to the capital. It was cancelled in 2013 amid the post-coup political crisis and militant occupation of the north. Artists say this year's festival is a chance to turn the page and refocus on the positive. Katerina Hoya reports from Bamako.
The theme of this year's Bamako Photo Biennale is Telling Time. Malian artist and documentary photographer Seydou Camara says this event is a chance to revive Mali's image. He says there's the hospitality and kindness towards strangers, the sun, the architecture, and the feeling that everything is possible. That's the Mali we as photographers need to show. Camara is showing work he shot in Timbuktu before the crisis. The city's historic architecture and ancient manuscripts were threatened by Islamist militants who occupied the north for 9 months in 2012 and 2013. Camara's images show the stacks of crumbling papers that local librarians would later smuggle to Bamako for safekeeping. Most of the mausoleums were destroyed and have only just now been rebuilt. Created in 1994, Bamako Encounters has become a key event for Malian African photography. The centerpiece is a group exhibition featuring 39 artists from countries in Africa, among them Mali, South Africa, Ghana, and Nigeria. Works are shown at the National Museum and around the city. This year's festival lets the visitors explore the archive of Bamako's many photo studios, including that of legendary Malian photographer Malik Sidibe, famous for his black and white portraits of youth and nightlife in the 1960s and 70s. Seydou Camara says Sidibe remains a touchstone. He says, Malik showed a vibrant youth. It's a work we need to continue, even if we don't do exactly like him. Photo studios can still be found all over Bamako, but their importance as incubators for young artists is diminishing. High-quality camera phones are increasingly affordable, and more Malians are using mobile phone applications like Instagram and Hipstamatic. This year's festival plans to incorporate work from the public. The project is called 1,384 Days, the period between the start of fighting in the north and the opening of Bamako Encounters on October 31st. People asked to contribute photos taken during the time. Selected images will be displayed on a photo walk in Bamako's National Park. This is Katerina Hoyet for VOA News in Bamako.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The citizens of Cote d'Ivoire went to the polls on October 25th to elect a president. All indications are that despite some relatively minor problems, such as polling stations opening late, the voting proceeded peacefully, and the process was transparent, inclusive, and credible. Sitting President Alassane Ouattara was re-elected to head the government of Cote d'Ivoire for the next 5 years. This year's election was important for the country's national recovery from years of violence and upheaval and a test of its stability. The last presidential election in 2010 was disputed, and the sitting president, Laurent Gbagbo, refused to acknowledge the fact that he had lost to former Prime Minister Ouattara. A months-long bitter political crisis followed, resulting in violent clashes between supporters of the two leading candidates and claiming some 3,000 lives. The people of Cote d'Ivoire should be proud of how far they have come during the past 5 years. Today, Cote d'Ivoire can consign that difficult and violent election to the past and resume its position as a regional leader. The United States government congratulates the Ivoirian people and President Ouattara. We also congratulate all candidates for waging a spirited and dignified campaign. They have proven that in a democracy, opposing sides can express different political views without resorting to hate speech or calls for violence and destruction. The Ivoirians who voted in great numbers demonstrated that they want Cote d'Ivoire to turn the page on past conflicts and that the country is ready to resume its traditional role as a political leader and economic engine for the subregion. As Cote d'Ivoire continues down its path of democratic consolidation and sustainable development, the United States of America will continue to be an active and engaged partner.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year.
but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.